had submitted some questions from the committee, and I guess we're going to start with Ms. Borgen. No? Who are we starting with?
Chair Pappas, members of the committee, my name is Manuel Lopez. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Programs, and I will begin the responses on the academic programmatic aspects of the questions you submitted, beginning with the Centers of Excellence.
Great. Thank you.
And just to keep you apprised, Wilder Research just completed an evaluation of the centers, and when the report is finalized, we'll make it ready to you. We'll provide it to you.
When do you expect that to be?
In a week or so.
Oh, fine.
With regard to the questions that were asked in terms of the Centers of Excellence and their impact, Brick broke it down into a couple of different areas. In terms of business relations, at least 339 businesses have been actively involved in the centers to date. As more relationships are built with industry associations as well as individual businesses, the potential sphere of influence of the centers extends well beyond this number. The business stakeholders who were surveyed in the fall of 2007 cited three main roles for the industry in the centers. One, to advise the centers. Secondly, to provide financial or in-kind support. And third, to provide real-world involvement. Business representatives confirm a largely positive perception of the center programs. Two-thirds, 67%, of those surveyed report that their center has made adequate progress. With regard to the aspect, with regard to students, centers are promoting a large number of events and activities to reach out to K-12 students and others who influence their career choices. The total number of youth reached through these activities totals at least 7,859. The centers are also deeply involved in efforts to strengthen the K-12 curriculum. Extending Project Lead the Way in middle schools and high schools, which is likely to increase the number of high school graduates continuing into college studies in science, technology, engineering, and mathematical fields. It's another impact. Centers are demonstrating a variety of strategies to bridge new students' transitions into college. There have been formalized relationships with K-12 programs to recognize and accept credits that were earned in Project Lead the Way classes and bridge programs to help incumbent workers and high school students achieve success in college.
Mr. Lopez, yes. Project Lead the Way was in existence before
yes.
this center. Yes,
but
existence, right?
We're talking about extending it and okay. relating it to the STEM fields.
Okay.
In terms of the colleges and universities, the centers have helped college and university departments and programs update their equipment and facilities. Faculty and administrators at two-year institutions are most likely to cite the importance and benefits of upgraded technology. The centers are promoting faculty involvement and professional development. Over half of the faculty respondents, 55%, reported that they had observed changes in how faculty teach, advise, or do research as a result of the center. 85% of this group reported changes in curriculum. 21% reported other changes affecting students, including improved career pathways, transferability of credits, opportunity for student projects. And 53% reported benefits to the faculty in terms of professional development, new research opportunities, and increased collaboration with industry. There are many new or updated courses and programs in center-related departments. Overall, 81% of the administrators who responded indicate that there have been new courses or programs developed at the institutions as a result of the center. And 60% report that existing courses or programs have already been updated or strengthened. Nearly 90% of administrators agree with the statement that the institution is committed to the sustainability of these centers. In terms of the issue of economic impact, although it's too early to know whether center programs help students receive better jobs, the intermediate measures of progress indicate that the centers are moving to fulfill their potential to enhance employment and economic activity in Minnesota. However, in many respects, it's too early for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities Centers of Excellence to have significant impact on the Minnesota economy. In terms of the state appropriation, question two, State appropriations for the Centers of Excellence have been allocated to the centers in the following way. The Center for Strategic Information Technology and Security, which is at Metropolitan State University, has received $4.4 million over four fiscal years. The Minnesota Center for Engineering and Manufacturing Excellence, which is based at Minnesota State University, Mankato, has received $5.1 million over 4 years.
That's from private industry or from foundations?
That's from the Centers of Excellence appropriation line in the budget provided to us.
Right.
The 360 Center for Applied Manufacturing and Industry, Applied Manufacturing and Engineering based at Bemidji State has received $5.1 million over 4 years, and the Health Force Center of Excellence based at Winona State has received $5 million. In terms of the question you just asked, the leverage funding piece, the Centers of Excellence have leveraged funding from a variety of public and private sources. In the 3 years of data that were provided by the Wilder Research Program evaluation, the Centers of Excellence have leveraged nearly $16 million in contributions to complement the $15 million in state funding over the for that same period. This includes contribution from a broad range of sources, including state and federal grants and institutional and industry partners. The Centers of Excellence funding designated by the legislature and the governor has been and will be critical for the ongoing sustainability of these entities. The legislative appropriation is the primary means by which the Centers of Excellence fund core operations. Much of the leveraged funding goes directly to the institutional partners for specific program development and equipment. Similarly, the funding for enrollments generated by the centers goes directly to the institutional partners. These unique collaborative and innovative models for workforce development would not be possible without the commitment of the legislature to provide the initial and ongoing support. And as the Wilder Research Program evaluation notes, the evidence to date indicates that the groundwork prepared in the first 3 years is just now reaching a point where the initial coordination and relationship building is ready to begin bearing fruit on a larger scale. So that you'll see that in the larger report. The next set of questions dealt with competitive salaries, and I'll respond to that in terms of 2005-2007 sessions. In terms of the use of salaries with the interfaculty organization, the system was able to put more money into the IFO faculty contracts in order to be more competitive with peers nationally.
Before you move on, Mr.
Yes.
Lopez, in terms of the Centers of Excellence,
yes.
Is the Wilder Report going to include any suggestions as to whether they should be continued or whether there are any improvements or any statutory changes that that we can make?
In terms of continuance and improvements, I believe so. They did a presentation to the board at the last board meeting. I wasn't there at that presentation, but I believe they did a summary of what they were going to present in the final report, and I believe they will have a series of recommendations.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Mr. Lopez, you know, for example, Mankato's campus was always known kind of for its engineering program, and we chose that, or the system chose that to, you know, focus it more even on a center of excellence. So what did that extra money buy? Did it expand the enrollment opportunities for students? Did it mainly buy equipment? What was the money used for?
Mr. Lopez.
Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling. State money was used to expand the programs and to create pathways with the two-year institutions, to create partnerships so that there were be clear channels or pathways, career pathways for students to move from the two-year institutions into the four-year institutions. A lot of, I just mentioned the leveraged equipment, a lot of the equipment came out of sources other than the money provided by the legislature. Curriculum development, clearer coordination, expansion of the faculties as well.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
And did more students enroll in the programs then? Have they seen an uptick in enrollment?
Lopez. Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling. I don't have that information. I can get it for you. It should be in the Roebling report. I'm sorry, in the Wilder report.
The Roebling report.
That sounds
Roebling
good.
Report
I'd like to read that
from Wilder.
You really want the Roebling building, though.
That'd be good.
Yeah, that'd be.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Lopez. Is that correct?
Did Associate Vice Chancellor, but that's fine.
Okay, you take the upgrade, huh? I'm reviewing. I'm looking at these list of goals, the essential goals of the Centers of Excellence, and listening to what you were talking about, especially about this transition between the 2 years and making certain that you strengthen and reach out to K-12 career choices, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. But what I'm looking at here as goals is providing Minnesota students with educational and economic opportunities equal to the best in the world, attracting students, faculty, and talent from outside of Minnesota, leverage external support from employers and other organizations. I heard you talk about that. Build more strategic educational system in greater Minnesota, strategic educational system, and ensuring its stature as a leader and innovator in education. Are you going to be talking about how that?
I think the Wilder report will do the evaluation, will indicate how much progress has been made. Bear in mind that this is a relatively new program. I know 3 years may not seem like new to you, but in an academic program of this kind, to ratchet it up and to get it to a level where it's producing at that level will take time. And I think that the comments from Wilder indicate that at least preliminarily they're on the right path. And in terms of strategic, the choice of the four centers was developed in conjunction with industry panels, and the four centers and the types of centers were reached in terms of advice from industry leaders in Minnesota. So I think that if you're talking about strategic, I believe that's been addressed by working with Minnesota business and industry leaders to try to address that. I think we've also got in choosing Minnesota State University Mankato, and in fact it's strength in engineering, that was a strategic choice in terms of placing it. The board made a decision to limit the number of centers. I think that's a strategic decision. But I think in terms of actually seeing return on investment, if you will, it'll be a little longer than the 3 years, but I think you will see in the more detailed Wilder report an indication that they're on the right path. And if they're not, they will point out where they think things might be improved.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to seeing that report. Why don't you continue with the next area?
On the issue of competitive salaries, the system was able to put more money into the IFO faculty contracts in order to be more competitive with peers nationally. They were significantly below their national peers. In addition, they used the money to create a university scholars program for faculty who have demonstrated outstanding teaching, service, or scholarship in 3 successive years, and placed some limitations on that with no more than 5% of the university's faculty or 10% of any department being designated as such.
So those were like bonuses, not
lump sum.
Lump sum. Senator Sharon, I think this is what you were talking about that was controversial, is the faculty bonuses that for excellence in teaching that were awarded. I just wanted to point that out to you because you mentioned it earlier. Okay, continue.
In the case of the 2-year faculty awards for excellence, the fiscal year 08-09 biennium, the system continued the program that was begun in fiscal year 06. Each college received an allocation of funds based on faculty full-time equivalents. Faculty could propose and receive approval for projects that demonstrated achievements above and beyond the normal requirements of the individual's position and which furthered the improvement of student learning outcomes. All CFA centers college faculty awards for excellence are restricted to faculty compensation. Each award for excellence is limited to $5,000 per project, and faculty could complete multiple projects. The program continues to be broadly and well received. Faculty find it as a way of achieving stretch goals, and administrators report that the high priority work is being done. In fiscal 08-09, there were 1,017 projects, not quite finished in 09, but there will be several more. And in fiscal 06-07, there were 1,226 projects, both totaling roughly $6.6 million in distributions in those years. A complete report for 06-07 is available on a web page, and I can provide that to you.
Okay. Mr. Lopez, I know that this request came to us because, on average, our faculty salaries are low.
Lower
than average, excuse me. Are we losing faculty to other states that are offering higher salaries? Do you know?
I would have to ask HR that, and that's not an area I keep track of. I can provide that information for you.
Yeah, because it seems like to back up this request, we really should look at it. Are we really losing faculty, talented faculty, or to other educational institutions like private colleges, too? That could be another thing. Yeah, Senator sure. Roebling.
Thank you. When you talk about 1,017 projects, and completion of these projects could result in a bonus award of like $10,000. No, up to
five. Maximum
up to five,
of six.
Or five or six?
Five, sorry.
$5,000. What are the projects?
They're basically curricular projects. But this is not one of the areas that I'm directly responsible for, but it's basically improvement in curriculum and improvement in opportunities for students to do hands-on type of research projects.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
And who reviews the projects to see if they are improving curriculum or student outcome?
That's done at the institutions, and then I assume also through the reporting to the Center for Teaching and Learning, which has been responsible for the distribution of the funds.
Madam Chair.
Is the Center for Teaching and Learning, is that a system-wide center?
System-wide center with representatives on every campus.
So is that considered part of the central office budget?
Part of it is.
Yeah, because we're trying to, that's one of our challenges, is to figure out exactly what the central office does. So whenever you do a central office function, tell us.
Okay.
All right. Senator Sharon.
You're speaking, thank you very much, Chair. You're speaking rapidly, and I'm going slow to integrate what you're saying, so I apologize if I'm speaking to
not
something you already said on this, because the competitive salary is the issue that I'm hearing about. That is whether or not, did I understand, based on what I did hear you say, that this objective or this goal was attempted to be achieved through these incentive grants for excellence, that's where the money went, rather than addressing the overall capacity to increase salaries so that in the general hiring practices we have competitive salaries?
Chair Pappas, Senator Sharon, they're actually dual track, if you will. The money's used within the interfaculty organization contract, that's the faculty for the baccalaureate institutions, was generally used in a broader to raise salaries to make them more competitive. The salaries in the Minnesota State College faculty tended to be closer to their peers nationally, and the money was used to incent extra work, extra projects that improved the curriculum and teaching.
Did that answer your question?
So slightly different approaches.
Contract, they were able to give them an increase in the salary in the contract, and they set up these special excellent teaching kind of awards. But I think we did hear some complaints about the those awards last year.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lopez, is that who we have up here now?
Yes, yes. Mr. Lopez.
Mr. Lopez.
Chancellor, Vice Chancellor.
When you say that are the salaries are low, where do you come up with that? I mean, you compare them to other states. Is it private colleges or two that you're looking at?
Mr. Lopez.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, there are national, you'd get a better answer from an HR person, but there's a, there are national databases, if you will, that are compiled for faculty and faculty salary. Generally speaking, those will be broken out by private colleges, public colleges, and within each of those categories, four-year in both public and private, purely research doctoral institutions like our sister institution, the University of Minnesota, the comprehensives like the seven state universities, and the privates, either research or akin to the institutions like Carleton and McAllister. So they're separated out, and those are usually the pools against which you compare. You compare against like institutions, peer institutions. It's not generally private against public or public. It's public institution with public institution, private institution with private, baccalaureate with baccalaureate, doctorate with doctorate.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Mr. Lopez, if we're comparing nationwide, if you go to California, which I have an uncle who lives in California, the cost of living there is a lot higher, so I would assume that those salaries would be a lot higher there, and the same thing in New York. So how can we say that these, if we're comparing, let's say, to something like that, hypothetical right. situation, how can we say that the salaries are low here?
Ms. Chancellor Lopez.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, they're not, the comparisons are generally not done dollar to dollar, they're done by quartiles or deciles. So you're looking at where an institution, where a faculty salaries place nationally. Are they in the first quartile, the second quartile, the third, or the fourth? And in the case of the interfaculty organization over the last few years, they have been just below the national median. So there are in essence averages. You're not comparing against the top. You're comparing against a set of data from the national pool that compares them all and puts them into different categories. And then you're comparing the salaries within the state of Minnesota in the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities to those quartiles and where they place on those.
Have we ever done any comparisons between the public colleges, the Minsky colleges, the University of Minnesota, and the private colleges in Minnesota?
Chair Papp.
Yes, Mr. Lopez.
Virtually every year, the Chronicle of Higher Education will do a data piece where they do faculty salaries, and they will do it
by state.
They will mix privates and publics so that you can actually, if you have access to their online version, can drill down to, if you want to do just Minnesota and you want to do just four-year institutions, you could get a list of those. But they don't necessarily, and they will do a summary comparison sheet for national level. But if you want state level, you would have to drill down. And they're generally not, again, the comparisons are not usually public-private, but the data's there in order to do it.
Madam Chair, I would just like to have, Mr. Lopez or somebody come back to us and let us know if we are losing instructors because we're not paying enough. I guess I'd like to know that, and anyway, I guess
that
I'd like to have
question.
Somebody get back to us on that.
Okay. Senator Sharon?
I think that was the – thank you very much, Chair. I think that was the challenge of being able to compete for – it wouldn't be a matter of not being able to find faculty, but compete for excellence in our faculty. So I'd be curious to know that – I mean, our goal was to try to make certain when we had a distribution of dollars to Minsky that some of those went to improve from below median
uh-huh.
to above median the salaries across the system. And you were just saying, I think I heard you say, that our Minsky system faculty are just below the median?
I don't track.
Chancellor Lopez.
Well, and maybe my better question would be, what I'd like to know is what it was before and whether or not as a result of the distribution of dollars
difference.
For faculty salaries, if you changed the placement of faculty salaries, which was what our goal was. for focusing on competitive salaries. Did that in fact happen?
Vice Chancellor Lopez.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I can't answer that. I'm not in HR, but I can get you the answer.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Can I add one more question to his list? one of the things that I think we were also looking for is what Senator Sharon was saying, that we were looking for certain very high-achieving faculty, and we wanted to make sure that we were able to retain the best. And how much ability did this money give you to pay a higher salary outside of what would be, I don't know, are you set up K-12, or do you already have the ability to pay the science instructors more than the history teachers or professors? I'm wondering how you're, because if there's some areas we really want to focus on and we really want top-notch instructors in, can you give them a higher salary, or are they all on the same grid? And does this money let you do that, more of that?
We need an HR person here. Mr. Lopez.
Madam Chair, though. Senator Roebling, an HR person, particularly someone in labor relations who could actually speak to you about the nuances of the contract and the limitations that imposes, would be someone who could answer that better. There is greater ability, at least on initial hire now, in the contract than there used to be for placement of people in fields that are highly sought after. The issues of how that impacts incumbents who are already here, I would have to defer to someone in HR who actually understands the salary distributions much better than I.
Since it's been a half hour and we're only through the first sections of our four-page questionnaire, I think you might be coming back. So hopefully you're making note of these questions so that when you come back we can have answers. Because, you know, I mean, we didn't expect you to be able to answer all the questions from the committee. Senator Tomasoni.
You know, and
I told my committee to ask questions.
I've always wondered this, because we always hear about losing the best and the brightest because we're not paying them enough. But how many of the best and brightest stay, and we don't know that they're the best and the brightest because they like being in Minnesota and they like living in the communities they're at, or even don't mind getting paid a little bit less because of the environment that they're living in rural Minnesota or whatever the situation may be? Do we know that? Because I got to believe that we got some pretty good professors in this state.
Vice Chancellor.
Or does that...
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, in some ways it's an HR question, but in other ways I can answer it, because if you look at one of the recent national professors of the year came out of one of our institutions. We have had significant numbers of faculty both at the two-year and at the four-year institutions that have won statewide, regional, and national awards for teaching and service. So I agree with you wholeheartedly that there are very good faculty at all our institutions. With regard to ability to retain and not lose, that type of record is probably best kept and best understood at the individual institutional level and at the programmatic level.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Thomas,
in addition to that, I got to believe that every single state loses people to other states, and that it's just a matter of progression. And it's not so much a matter of losing the best and the brightest, but people might just be looking for a change. You may have gotten an increase in salary at the same time, but
Or their spouses
are moving location. They came from a different state, so they want to go back to that state, whatever the case may be. But I think we place way too much emphasis on this. We need more money for people so that we can get the best and the brightest, because we're losing them. And I'm not sure I buy into the theory.
Senator Sharon.
Well, I do think that when you have an indicator that you can't hire or you can't hold, and people are communicating in their exit interviews that this is the issue, then you have data rather than just assumption. And I do think that I'd be interested to know. I think we need to have some measures about this that we can agree upon. in an exit interview, we ought to know if this is what the issue is, or we ought to know why people are not coming here. And I think that we are able to demonstrate that this is part of the reason. That's why this became an issue during the last budget session. And this, these measures of excellence that you're talking about, that our professors within our Minsky system are getting recognized for research or for recognized for the work that they're doing in engineering from the centers of excellence. If we have a center of excellence, are we demonstrating some excellence in terms of those things that are nationally recognized? We want to build that. And those, to me, would be more of a measure of whether or not we're achieving our objective here for excellence in our professors, and really measuring whether or not our salaries are creating a problem for us in terms of drawing and keeping excellence.
Okay. Any more questions on competitive salaries? All right, then continue.
You also asked questions on serving the underserved and the power of you. And in approving the allocation for serving the underserved, the board expressed its expectation that the funding would be used to establish the created new or expanded existing programs for recruitment and retention of underrepresented students. We're not aware of any instances where the money the board appropriated for these new centers, where existing staff were simply shifted to new funding, to the new funding source while performing their previous duties. In most cases, individuals paid from the allocation made to address underserved students are new hires. In some cases, there were existing staff who were transferred to newly created positions made possible by the funding, and their previous duties were backfilled by other staff or new hires. For example, a college may have appointed a current staff member to be the director of a new recruitment new retention program. That frequently avoids long delays and expense in the search process and assures that a qualified person is going to step in and hit the ground running. Except for the Power of You program, we're not aware of any overlap between the this funding and other sources of funding for these programs. In a number of cases, the funding's been used to expand a current program that's not able to serve additional students. For example, Southwest Minnesota State University created a program called Access to Opportunity that replicates an existing TRIO student support services program that was not able to serve additional students. By creatively leveraging this existing program, the university is able to serve many more underrepresented students than it would otherwise have been possible. You also asked how much money, was raised to match the Power of You. A total of $5.2 million has been raised from private foundations, corporations, and individual donors.
Yes.
Approximately $811,000 of that has been raised since May of 2008. About half of the total amount that I mentioned has come from seven large foundations. We can also provide you a full listing if you so.
I think we were also interested in what other state funding sources the Power of You received. Because when you were here, when they were here last with the Power of You, it looked like there had been ICAP grants, and that some of the serving the underserved money was being used for the Power of You program. So that's what we were kind of trying to get after. You know, it's not that that's wrong, but we just didn't know that some other state sources were being used for that particular program.
Can I ask one of my colleagues to respond?
Another Mr. Lopez.
Yes.
Are you guys related?
No.
Just kidding.
I'm the younger, handsomer one.
Yeah.
They're twins.
They're twins, right.
Chair Pappas, Lopez. Mike Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs. There was funding from the Access and Opportunity and Success Initiative that was used by the three Power of You institutions. Minneapolis Community and Technical College received $386,000, which they used for that purpose. St. Paul College received $240,000, which they used for that purpose. And Metropolitan State University received $243,000. They did not use all of that funding for their power of view. They used only a portion of it. I don't know exactly what the portion was, but they did use some of that. In terms of ICAP and other sources, I don't have that information with me, but we can get it and report that to you.
I would also be interested in knowing, with all these different funding sources for the power of view, how much of that is going directly to for student tuition, and how much of it is going for mentoring services or whatever else you provide, or recruitment services, or exactly how that's all broken down.
Senator Pappas, it sounds like you're asking for a budget breakdown for
yes.
the Power of You programs.
Yes, okay. That would be helpful.
We can ask for that.
Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair, can I ask?
Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I didn't ask, I should have asked this question when the word was said, but I didn't want to look stupid in front of the committee, but I guess I'm going to ask it anyway.
there are no stupid questions, only stupid people. No, that's not right.
I don't
there
know
are
what
no stupid people, only stupid questions.
I don't know what quartile means.
Quartile. It's something to do with four, right?
Either break down the salaries into the bands of four, or quintiles would be bands of five, and place particular institutions, let's say Bemidji State University, place its average salaries in one of those
quartiles.
If you're at the top of the quartile, then the fourth quartile, you're usually doing extremely, the top quartiles doing extremely well. Essentially, the split between the second and the third quartile is your median. That's the quick answer. There are quintiles. I think the materials that the Chronicle does, generally they give you summary dollars average, and I think they provide deciles or tenths. It's in more detail when they do it on an annual basis.
Senator Coring, did you say you were taking a Minnesota history class
I'm taking American government.
American government? Maybe you should take math.
Thank you for making me look good in the committee.
Well, I told him that he should be teaching American government, not taking that class.
I'm actually learning a lot. Yeah. Learned about the 48 election last night. So
nice.
So then I would say that us as legislators are in the low tile then, or
the fourth quartile.
We're on the tile they walk on.
Senator, Madam Vice Chair, would you come and chair? I have a bill up, so I'll be back in a few minutes.
He's having too much fun here. Excuse me.
So this is we're speaking about the power of you. Is there any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Roebling.
Just going back to the services for the underserved, not power of you necessarily, but we all already had some programs in place for the underserved before we put the additional funding into it. So have you any figures or numbers to show us how many more students have we served with the additional dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, we did in fact ask the colleges and universities to provide that information. The information the reports that we've received from the colleges and universities indicate that they were able to serve about 13,000 more underrepresented students than they had previously been serving.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Roebling.
Do you have any breakdown on what the cost per student was then?
Mr. Lopez.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, the colleges and universities spent about $5.2 million on retention efforts. That is, of the $7.4 million that was allocated for access, opportunity, and success, $5.2 million was spent on retention. So if you break that down by the approximately 13,000 students, it would be probably less than $400 per student.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rubin.
So when will we know if those efforts were successful and that we've retained more students or interested more underserved students in going to college and being better prepared for it?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, we did in fact
Mr. Lopez?
receive reports from the colleges and universities on their fall-to-fall retention rates. And the data that we have indicate that the students that were served by these programs did have retention rates that were comparable to the retention rates of other students. That is the all college or all university retention rate. If you go on the assumption that these populations were probably students who were high risk students compared to the all university average, then having the retention rates be comparable, the GPAs be comparable, I think is a measure or an indication of success.
Are there any other questions? I was wondering, you know, we've asked you, and you've spoken about other sources of funding that you've been able to bring to the table for this program. Can you remind me, is the goal in terms of seeking private funding for this, that this eventually become a self-sustaining program? What is your understanding of the goal here in relationship to this program and its funding stream?
Senator Sharon, I do believe that it would be one of the goals of the program to be a self-sustaining program. I don't know whether that's achievable in the short term, but I do believe that was one of the primary goals.
And in terms of what you've been able to do in fundraising, you don't know that that's going to be a possibility, but do you have a sense of whether or not there's enough interest in there in this kind of program from the private donors that we'll be able to pull back some of the public funding and whatever the stream is and utilize it for other initiatives?
Senator Sharon, I'm probably not qualified to answer that question. The Power of You programs are not operated out of the Office of the Chancellor. They are operated at the individual colleges and the university. They're the ones that are doing the fundraising and the operations, and so it would probably be someone from the university or the colleges that could answer that question better.
Okay, thank you. Anything further? We can move to technology.
Thank you.
Yes. Who will be coming to speak on this issue?
I will, and I'm sorry there's a little confusion about the order here.
Madam Chair, as she approaches,
yes.
Is there,
Senator Wieger.
Is there any handout by Minsky on any of the items being responded to?
Vice Chancellor Lopez, will you be able to provide us something in writing from today in terms of response to all of the questions that we've asked here?
Senator Sharon, yes, we will.
Thank you very much. I think that's a great question because I did find that I was maybe not picking up something that you moved forward on because I was still trying to integrate something you
sure.
had said. So that would be very helpful. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Joanne Chabot. I'm a deputy CIO for the Minnesota State College and University System and appreciate being here today. You asked a set of questions about funding for technology in the system. And the answers to the question.
Before you do that,
sure.
Would you mind just, I think what's helpful to me is if you would orient us to what your understanding was of why we focused on specific requests and actions on the part of Minsky as it relates to technology and what your understanding is of what it is we're seeking to understand was achieved in this area of technology.
Are you asking if what my understanding is about the specific request you made to bring back some information about the funds and how they were used?
Your understanding of what it was we were trying to achieve with that expenditure,
yes.
And that what we're asking for you now is a report back on whether or not that was accomplished. So
okay.
If you orient with a goal,
okay.
And then you're responding by answering our question.
Right. Well, my understanding and my hope is that we all had the common goal of shoring up a technology infrastructure that was in terrible condition a few years ago to the point where students were unable to register. Students were unable to take a test in D2L. Faculty were unable to put grades up in a timely manner because the technology itself was in very rocky shape. We had very old technology, 11-year-old equipment, in some cases no longer supported by the vendors. We hadn't kept pace with the new web type functionality that students, faculty, administrators, and the public really has a right to expect. So the request was made to the legislature for an infusion of capital that would allow replacement of obsolete technology and would allow us to begin making progress towards providing the kinds of features and functions that students and the public were asking for. Now, the original appropriation or allocation from the Board of Trustees was a little bit more than $46 million. From that amount of money, we took $5 million and distributed it immediately to campuses. Campus-specific technology also needed infrastructure work. The remaining sum we kept within the shared service environment. I think you're all aware that that we operate in a very efficient shared environment where the campuses do have some technology within their own institutions, so computer labs is one example. There are other things as well. But the major systems like the student registration, payroll, budget, D2L, the learning management systems, those things are all shared, so they share the costs in our central office. And that's also an answer to a question I think you asked earlier about let us know when something is done in the office of the chancellor. The lion's share of technology, campus technology, is done in the office of the chancellor. Now, so the following year of the biennium, there was a slowing of the pace a bit because in addition to the campus allocation that we awarded the prior year, we repeated it, but we increased it. So $7.5 million from the $46 million went to the campuses. And we had a legislative cut of $5 million. And then most recently, our share of the unallotment was $580,000. So this year's funding level was a little bit over $33 million. So we have slowed the pace, obviously, of those improvements. Nonetheless, I think we owe you a huge thanks for, and I think the students and faculty would agree, for it providing, for the first time since I've been with the system, a smooth fall start. We actually had students able to do what they needed to do on the first day of class and throughout the drop-ed period. And that, if you sit in my seat, you'll know how remarkable that was. It was stable, and that's a very good thing. We also have managed to completely replace some of our oldest equipment, some of the 11-year-old unsupported equipment, and we are very close to being able to leave behind a database system that you probably never heard of. It's called RDB, and that's a bad thing. If you've not heard of it, it's not something that you want in an infrastructure that supports 300,000+ students. So we've been making really good progress on the foundation. We've also, unfortunately, at a slower pace, done some things in the last year or so that are translating into improved efficiencies for students in the campuses. One of the examples I'd like to throw out is e-transcript that we'll be rolling out in a couple of weeks that will allow students to, in an automated way, move their transcripts around the system instead of having to go pay for a transcript at each college and university and send it around. That's going to be huge, and it's one of the students' top priorities. We also have rolled out an electronic application system so students can apply using an electronic system to all institutions they'd like to apply to at the same time. And that's wonderful. A few months ago, we implemented a student help desk where I have staff located around the state, and in this particular case, staff located in the Granite Falls office received direct calls from students or prospective students, and that means parents in many cases, as they're trying to apply and they can't figure out how to do something or they're confused by academic terminology or whatever it might be. We take those calls directly for them. So we've dramatically increased customer service. Now, I don't want to suggest that we're where we need to be, because we're not. We were in very bad shape before this additional infusion of money, so we're not where we need to be, but I think we've made some really extraordinary progress.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes, Senator Roblin.
I'm just trying to figure out the math of it. The original appropriation you said was for
46,355,000.
And so we're getting close to the end of this biennium. And how much of it was already spent, And how much was remaining? You said you slowed down some of your
efforts. The first year of the biennium, the allocation was $46,355,000, of which $5 million we sent to campuses. The second year was a little different. The current year, we increased the amount we sent to the campuses, $7.5 million. But we also took a legislative reduction in the amount of $5 million and an unallotment in the amount of $580,000. So the available funds for spending centrally this year were $33,275,000, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, $33,275,000. Depending on how you look at it, you could add back in the $7.5 million that we sent to campuses. And if you're focusing on the entire amount of money available for technology, it would have been $40 million. If it's just the Office of the Chancellor component, the shared environment that you're looking at, then it would be $33 million.
Senator Rowland.
Has all of that money, are there plans for all of that money now? I mean, that it'll be spent soon, or there's still some unallotted?
We believe we'll end up the year close to zero. We have a lot of purchases that are in the form of leases, so we have ongoing costs. So the monies that we spent last year, we also are repeating this year in the form of lease payments and, of course, staff salaries and that sort of thing. There were some projects, because the only discretionary funding that we had to respond to the legislative reduction and the unallotment was in projects, we did have to reduce projects. And as far as I know, and I've been looking at the numbers regularly with our budget director, we won't have a penny left over at the end of the year.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chauvin. Senator Wieger.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. For online learning opportunities, did part of this go for that?
Oh, absolutely, a huge part of it. We've spent a lot of money on additional hardware and infrastructure needed to support online learning, from things like the servers, you might imagine that, but also additional licenses. Actually, internet bandwidth. We had to procure a substantial amount of internet bandwidth in order to support the expansion in online learning, and there are many other things. Those are obvious and large, but there were a lot of expenditures for online learning.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Wieger,
the technology fee that a student pays, has that gone up in the past few years?
Ms. Chauvin.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that that's an institution-by-institution decision, and I can get that information to you if that would be helpful. I don't have that at the time.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Ms. Chauvin, you may be able to answer this and just on the backs of that question, if the campuses are charging that fee, is that supplementing some campus-related goal or objective in technology that supplements this $4 or $5 million, $7.5 million that you send to the campuses?
It is. It does.
Can you differentiate what the responsibility of the campuses are for this technology money as opposed to the central system?
Yes, Madam Chair. The campuses support their students in their lab environments at the college and university. They also provide a lot of support directly to faculty. So, for example, a faculty member walks into a classroom, the technology isn't working, they would contact the help desk at that institution, and staff employed at that institution would come out and repair the equipment and get things running. Typically, the technology monies that are collected at the campus level support that function. Now, the kinds of things that we do in the shared environment are the students applying for admission, registration, payment, financial aid, every bit of business processing that is done to support students actually getting into the system and paying bills at the system, that sort of thing is all done in the shared technology environment.
So would something like... Michelle, but would something like the support services the faculty need to use D2L or to develop a course online on the campus would have to come out of this money that's going to the campuses?
Madam Chair, no. Actually, we provide those services in the form of we provide a centralized help desk for them, a centralized support structure for them. We pay for the D2L licenses at the system office. So, no, that is all a part of the funding that you provide to us. Now, there is probably, in fact, definitely on each institution, there's a person that we would call the D2L coordinator, and that person would be funded by at the campus level, and that person would probably be the first line of support for many faculty questions. But we would be the second, third, fourth, and fifth level of support.
Can you, could you help me understand how you make the decisions about where you're going to invest this money, is centrally or on the campuses? What is the basis of your decision making?
We established a process. It's called the Enterprise Investment Process, and it includes a governance structure that is composed with a majority of presidents, but also the three vice chancellors and the senior vice chancellor sit on that committee. They meet regularly, monthly actually, and they both allocate the funds to projects based on proposals that come forward from the campuses or from staff within the office of the chancellor, and they also monitor progress and make adjustments and tweaks. So if a project is going over budget, for example, they may choose to provide additional funding or to cut the scope or potentially to kill the project, although that hasn't happened. It's a pretty disciplined process. It requires people like my staff or people on the campus to submit to that group a statement of this is the goal that I have, this is the project, this is what I think would be accomplished, this is what I think it would take. And from that group would either say, yeah, that's a good idea, or not so good, or not strategic, or whatever. If they think it's a good idea, they would actually go back to that group and say, flesh it out. Now we want a complete business case. We want to know exactly what it would cost. We want to know all the dependencies. And then finally they would make a decision to fund the project or not based on that.
Are you able to identify savings achieved by this technology, either in personnel or dollars and cents?
Well, it's to some extent, yes. I mean, we could take something like an electronic transcript and translate how much savings might be the result of that, because we know what the standard costs for processing documents are. Some of the other activities that have occurred as a result of this are really more cost avoidance. So, for example, we've put in a number of changes to shore up the security infrastructure for the systems to prevent breaches and hacking. Well, it's hard to quantify what savings are achieved. It's really cost avoidance. So between the two of those things, I think we could probably provide some information about that might be helpful if you would like it.
Perhaps the better question is, are you looking for savings? Are you looking for what are you looking for in the investment that helps you decide where to make the investment, and so that we know what the goals are here?
Right. The Enterprise Investment Committee did have a number of goals, and cost savings was one of them. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the only one, though. They also wanted to follow some of the other strategic objectives of the Board of Trustees, like increasing access and opportunity for students. So some projects, theoretically, while they might not save costs, would help us to serve the underserved, or, as another example, provide data about whether or not we're accomplishing our goals. One of the projects that the board has the Enterprise Investment Committee has authorized is development of better metrics to provide you and the public and decision makers so that we know if programs are working. It's called an action analytics project. Or recently you've probably seen the dashboard. That's one of the projects
initiatives
as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be good for us to see that. Okay, is there anyone else who would have a question on technology?
You have a question?
Are you going to be speaking to another subject here?
I am not. We will pass it back to
performance funding indicators and results. Welcome back to the committee.
Madam Chair. I will attempt to address the questions more directly without increasing the speed of my delivery. As you're aware, the Minnesota State Colleges Universities achieved all five of the performance goals that was specified in the laws of Minnesota 2007. The first goal was to increase by at least 3% the number of students in STEM courses. Enrollment in college-level STEM courses increased by 3.2% between fiscal year 2005 and the preliminary fiscal year 2008 figures. Second goal was to increase by at least 2% the number of students in Center of Excellence courses, and the enrollment in the Centers of Excellence increased by 2.3% between fiscal years 2005 and 2007. The third goal was to get students trained in electronic medical record technology, increased by at least 700, the number of students that were trained in that fashion. The number of students trained on electronic medical record technology increased by 971 between fiscal year 2007 and the preliminary fiscal year 2008 data. A fourth goal that was presented was to increase by 10% compared to fiscal 2007 the number of students taking online courses or the number of online courses offered. Enrollment in online courses increased by 11.3% between fiscal year 2007 and the preliminary data we have for fiscal year 2008. And in the fifth goal was to expand by at least 10% compared to calendar year 2006, the use of awards of excellence or other initiatives that reward member institutions to advance excellence and efficiency. And the number of awards of excellence increased by 277.5% between calendar year 2006 and 2007. Another question that was asked was whether these goals were a challenge. Yes, they were indeed a challenge, even though we achieved them all. Three of the goals, you will note, the students in STEM courses, the students in Center of Excellence courses, and in online courses were achieved by relatively small margins on the enrollment basis. The other two goals, students trained in electronic medical record technology and awards of excellence, were relatively new initiatives that were achieved by larger margins as a result of focused efforts. Do they remain enduring goals? I think all five goals reflect enduring initiatives for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. The system would rather not have base appropriations that are contingent on achieving specified goals, but they are still part of our standard operating procedure, if you will.
Are there any questions?
Senator Weaver. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lopez, for number one, may I assume that for the math courses on the STEM, those would be non-remedial courses?
Oh, all.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Wager. All the records that were given to you in terms of student enrollments are for non-remedial courses. Okay. They would have to be credit-bearing courses that were counted towards some sort of formal award, whether it's a certificate or a degree.
And Senator Madam Chair, Mr. Lopez, on goal four, do you have a further breakdown? It says 10% additional students taking online or number of courses offered. Maybe I was reflecting on some other part of your testimony. Did you indicate a breakdown on that?
It indicated that it was 11.3% increase in enrollment.
And on course, Madam Chair, for courses offered?
I don't have that information, but I can get it for you.
As it's a goal, that would
be. Yeah, yes. That would be helpful. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to that. Any other questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just sort of joining the discussion, but we're talking about the performance funding
indicators. Yes.
And just a more general question that I had was, you have these performance indicators, and I presume that overall the institution has some goals, and I presume that each individual campus has some goals and initiatives that they're striving for. And I'm wondering to what degree all of those things are coordinated or run parallel or perhaps don't. And the reason, frankly, for my question is that I know that we direct some what are very limited resources towards this end, and I'm wondering if that's the most beneficial use of those dollars or if this is causing another layer or series of goals and how they all coordinate together.
Assistant Vice Chancellor. Associate Vice Chancellor Lopez.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I'm not quite tracking the question in the sense that each campus...
Assistant Vice Chancellor, I think you started to refer to that a little bit. If I can, you were talking about your preference would be not to have these performance indicators, and perhaps you could talk about why that is.
They make it very, as you indicate, make it difficult to assign, if you will, targets to every institution. The institutions are unique. They have different catchment areas, different types of students, different programmatic mixes. We do have alternate, if you want, we have existing means of doing accountability that uses a set of metrics that are somewhat different from the five that were prescribed.
So I take it that the difficulty is in aligning those reports, but Senator Lynch, I think, was talking about, I'll have her speak for herself, is about multiple layers of goals and objectives and measures that you're asked to respond to. Senator Lynch, perhaps I'll ask you to focus your question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
You have these goals, you have institutional goals, you have site goals. There are dollars allocated to these funding indicators, and I'm just trying to determine whether or not this is a good use of our resources and how that may or may not coordinate with all of these other series of goals and objectives that you have, both those set by the legislature and those that are determined by the sites. And since we have limited resources and we need to focus on student achievement, are we doing that as efficiently and effectively as we can?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, yes and no. I think you're correct in saying that there are multiple sets of goals out there. I think that in particular some of these goals that were for which we were asked to achieve certain targets in terms of a performance return allocation to the system are consistent with existing goals that come out of the strategic plan. For instance, the STEM piece is obviously consistent with what our board and our administrations are looking at. The Centers for Excellence was while it was shaped in a slightly different way than we had anticipated, was already something that was in progress within the system and we were leaning towards. The online courses are a major component of our educational enterprise. So I think that there are some things that when they dovetail, and some of these dovetailed very well, are much more consistent with the strategic planning of the system and the direction we're intending to go. And there are some others that are not quite as they don't fit as readily, if you will.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Assistant Vice Chancellor. It might be helpful for us as we continue to scrutinize the appropriations and where the dollars are directed, if there are suggestions of indicators that perhaps are obsolete or in this day perhaps not as pertinent to the overall discussion, it might be helpful to have that communicated to the division so that we can take that into consideration.
Did anyone ask the question about, if Minsky thinks that these should be continued, or are we talking about now they maybe should be altered, changed? Okay.
Chair Pappas, I believe I commented on behalf of the Office of the Chancellor and the Board that the system would rather not have base appropriations that are contingent on achieving specific goals, but I was also, in response to a question Senator Lynch put forward, indicating that several of these were consistent with the strategic plan of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and then the action or work plans that emanate from that strategic plan on a shorter basis.
So if we were going to have, though, contingent funds, we should align them with systems goals and statutory goals, so that we're all kind of on the same page.
That would be very helpful.
Okay. Well, give us a proposal.
Cheap one.
um, Is there, I'm sorry, I just having been out of the room, is there any more on performance funding indicators? Are we done with that topic? Okay, then we can move on.
You had questions on community energy and on ongoing funding. There were several demonstration projects that were
funded. Talk about the non-resident tuition funding already, or is that someone else going to do that? You're going to lay to that later. Okay, great.
Working on that.
On the community energy appropriation for projects, demonstration projects, and you asked for amounts. Inver Hills Community College received $40,000. Mesabi Range College received $133,334. Minnesota West received the same, $133,334. Riverland, the same, $133,333. Each of them took on projects that were specific to the institution. Inver Hills engaged, Inver Hills Community College engaged Ed Cook and Associates in helping the college explore energy alternatives, wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass. And the funds are critical for Inver Hills Community College to implement a number of suggested alternatives. Mesabi Range took approximately one-third of the dollars that have been used for one-time expenditures working with the City of Mount Iron Development Authority on projects related to wind logistics at Embarrass Mountain, including a study and site preparation for the installation of a wind turbine. The balance of the funds is being used for ongoing expenditures in the planning of coursework to be offered at Mesabi Range Community and Technical College with regard in renewable energy and wind energy areas. The response from the institution was that if the funds were not received, the college would not be able to offer and deliver the courses that are being developed. Riverland College spent a significant amount of time looking at ideas and how to best use these funds to maximize its impact on the college, on the K-12, and on the community. And this spring, the college is planning for the construction of a wind turbine and solar panels at the Albert Lee campus. The college is also using some of the funds for curriculum development for a new wind energy maintenance program. And at Riverland, that will be a branch of their existing construction electrician program.
So, Mr. Lopez,
yes.
Was this a one-time grant to these institutions, or is it intended to be ongoing?
Ongoing. It's ongoing.
It's ongoing. Yeah. Okay. So once they complete their windmill, I mean, it seems to me there must be some one-time costs involved, and once they develop their curriculum, why does it need to be ongoing? What else are they going to do with it in the future? Or can't you then move on to assist other colleges with similar programs?
Madam Chair, I assume that there will be some continuing funding to the institutions as they complete their projects, and that if the money is in the base, that it will be reallocated to similar projects at other institutions.
Okay. Any questions on community energy? Oh, I'm sorry, were you finished?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. Continue.
There was also a question on the economic development eFolio upgrade. The Career eFolio Minnesota is piloting in northeast Minnesota and hosted by Mesabi Range Community and Technical College. Has taken root, made progress over the course of its first year, and continues to grow and serve its mission and goals. In response to the national economy and the detrimental effects and looming threats on stable employment, the Career eFolio Minnesota's mission, goals, and commitment to enhance workforce initiatives and advance economic development are more essential than ever in the view of Mesabi Range CTC. The project impact, they have employed three full-time and one part-time staff, one full-time AmeriCorps Vista volunteer, and two work-study students on the Eveleth campus in the eFolio Community Training Center and office to meet its mission of enhancing workforce initiatives and advancing economic development. The project has been progressing to integrate eFolio on a region-wide basis, which has required significant and specific marketing, partnership building, planning, and training activities. And you also asked how many people are using the system, how many employers have access to the system.
while accounting for all of the individuals who've actually engaged in eFolio as a result of our marketing extension efforts can be difficult, Career eFolio Minnesota has done firsthand presentations and trainings to a current count of 3,412 individuals, including students, workforce agency and economic development center staff, community members, job seekers, human resource managers, and education faculty, staff, and administrators.
I don't remember this. This was a House initiative. I don't really know what this is. It's like a resume bank, or it's a, I guess I can't get my handle on exactly what eFolio means.
It's basically an electronic portfolio, an electronic resume, but it has more flexibility, if you will, than a paper portfolio. It allows you to include all sorts of materials that make it clearer what your skills and experiences and abilities are in terms of videos. In this case, perhaps not, but a music student would be able to include a musical composition, an artist, pictures of his or her artwork.
Assistance.
Yes.
To help people once they leave the college, you know, be matched up with the appropriate.
In this particular case, it wasn't based only for people at the college. It was based on one of the legislatively mandated functions of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, which is to engage in economic development. So it's broader. It extends out into the community, into the K-12 system, and into the workforce development centers. It's not just at
for
the
students.
Institution. Yes.
It's for the entire community. Senator Roebling and Senator Sharon.
You said that you had had presentations to 3,400 people. How many people actually have posted portfolios on the system?
This is run by the institution. I can't answer that question, but I can seek an answer. Again, it's based at the Northeast Higher Education District, and I can ask.
It was part of the original, how many people are using the system, was one of the requests.
Well, the current count was that we know how many people they did presentations to. I don't know how many people are using the system.
Are actually posting their resumes online. Yeah.
And Madam Chair.
And then also, are employers actually using it? What's the usage of employers? Are they going online to look for employees?
That was my question, too.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm a little puzzled about, it sounded like there were 3.5 staff people involved in this initiative, and I'm kind of, they do presentations, they probably do some.
To employers?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what their role is.
Senator Sharon?
That was essentially my question as well, but I can't remember, what was the appropriation for this? We probably have that somewhere.
It's $225,000 a year, and it's ongoing.
And it's ongoing.
Yeah. So I guess we need a little more information about this. Understand this better. Any other questions people have that they want answered? Next time we're going to make Senator Tomasoni answer this question.
Well, you got to tell me before.
All right. Well, Senator Lynch.
She doesn't even know
when
he had the question.
Madam Chair, on this note, it might be good, since this is relatively new, if we had some testimony or had some indication as to whether or not this is doing what it was intended to do. Should we continue doing this? Does it need to be expanded or not?
Right, and frankly, you know, I think Minsky is going to have to tell us if, given the enormity of the budget problem, how they're going to allocate cuts. You know, and in some of these specially funded programs, are we going to be able to continue these, or will they just get a proportionate cut? You know, we might have to make decisions.
This particular program has also secured additional funding. Or support in the sense that the project has been awarded a grant for a full-time AmeriCorps VISTA worker for 3 years and has secured a 2-year grant of $100,000 from the American Association of Community Colleges. So there is some additional resources outside those of the state of Minnesota. But
and somebody else out there thinks this is a good idea.
Yeah.
So or needed. Yeah, Senator Clark?
Madam Chair, you know, actually, I might be able to hold mine off. How far are you hoping, given the time we're going to get today? Because it sounds like members have a lot of questions that Minsky may need to come back and give some answers.
Right.
And I just want to add to the mix before we're done. So are we going to try to get through the rest of this list?
Yes.
Okay.
As far as we can until our
Madam
time
Chair,
is
just,
up.
I think what you were asking, just in terms about some direction with what Minsky is going to be looking at with budget cutting, and how it relates both from both a central office standpoint and a campus standpoint. And this is a tiny project, but it may relate to both places. So it would just be helpful for us to have a better handle on how much are the efficiencies internally within central offices versus within the campuses, and then what with each of these different kinds of special projects, but even in the broader standpoint, what the impacts are going to be that you're looking at. Because we know the youth started looking at or is making some changes. We know you've been making changes, but it just would be helpful for us to know as we're moving along.
Okay, Mr. Lopez.
The next set of questions was on the Northeast Higher Education District's Range Vocational Education Project, its ongoing funding. This relates to the Applied Learning Institute, which was formed in 2006 to enhance the curriculum in Northeast Minnesota by providing experiential learning that combines hands-on training and technology. The mission of ALI is to prepare students to be highly trained, knowledgeable workers who are equipped with the technical and problem-solving skills necessary in the ever-changing world of work. The Applied Learning Institute is a partnership that connects 16 northeastern Minnesota school districts with the five colleges of the Northeast Higher Education District. The coordinator and assistant meet quarterly with school superintendents and college provosts, as well as monthly meetings with committees of high school principals, college deans, and other pertinent high school and college staff to discuss and plan their programming in the school. Students in some programs of study utilize online learning or attend classes at the community and technical colleges. Other programs of study utilize a qualified teacher in the classroom, or a college faculty member may travel to the high school for instruction or teacher mentoring. During the 2008-2009 school year, 1,012 students were impacted by the programs from this institute.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
What was the budget for this again?
$1 million.
Is that million a year?
A year.
When you said the impacted, do you mean that the student
served.
Participated,
yes.
Served? Okay. So how is this, I'm trying to understand how this is different from what we already do with PSEO and College in the Schools. I know that Representative Rukavina Headed have concerns about not enough students on the range participating in college opportunities. But some of what you were talking about, there seemed like there could be some overlap here, so not quite sure.
I think the focus is on the vocational.
The vocational training?
Yeah.
It's more of a vocational training approach.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this isn't direct relation. Actually, the IRRRB is participating in this also. And this is in direct relation to the type of things that are going on in the Aran Range in regards to about $6.5 billion of investment that's going on in the various mineral industries, and trying to make sure that the kids are having the opportunities to train for the jobs. And in addition, Virginia is a really good example of a high school that, and I think all of them probably have done it, that have eliminated their vocational training. And in Virginia, for example, had at one point in time 12 industrial arts teachers. They have one today. And the kids are obviously doing what everybody else is doing. They're trying to pass tests so that the school can look good on their national scores, and And I think we're probably missing a lot of kids that are want to get into some type of vocational training. We're getting to the point where people who are working in the mines are getting to the 30-year limit and getting ready to retire, and there aren't a lot of people coming up through the high schools with the training that they could possibly have. And this is kind of trying to get the high schools and the colleges together to get kids doing both.
Because the equipment and the instructors are now at the college level. I think we had a presentation on a similar thing. Was it Anoka Technical College is right next door to a high school, and a lot of the high school students can take these vocational-type classes at the college.
Madam Chair, this was in essence a replication or a form of replication of that same model in a larger geographic area.
Okay.
And they are basically programs of study, are the technical or vocational programs that have not had available faculty to them in construction trades and industrial technology, in pre-engineering and natural resources, and a number of other fields.
So do they, you said it was a mixture. Sometimes the college instructors go to the high school and provide the programs, and sometimes the students go to the college to take the classes, so I suppose they provide some transportation or what?
Are
they taking courses online? So the state appropriation goes to pay for what?
Curriculum development? It's a direct allocation to the Northeast Higher Education District, so I assume it involves the curriculum development and the involvement of the faculty at the five colleges, plus activities that involve the partner institutions, whether they're school districts or, in this case, a number of additional community-based organizations, the Blandin Foundation, Minnesota Power, a number of others are involved. So I'm assuming that there are incidental costs for getting people together and providing information and materials.
We asked for something from Mr. Lopez on the power of you. What was that? It was like the budget. I think that would be useful to have on this, too. So we see
I will ask them for that.
Private sources of funding and actually what the money is going for. Are we paying for tuition for students or what? Yes, Senator Roble.
Yeah, Madam Chair, looking at the figures, unless I need to go back to math school, too, it's about $10,000 per student that was served. And I'm wondering how many college credits did these students receive for that money, because typically that would be a full course of tuition for a two-year technical college. You could complete 2 years of technical college for $10,000 easily.
Yeah.
So I'm
just
really
giving the kids the money.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Go to technical school.
Plus, there's
unless they're buying equipment or there's some other big expense in here that we don't know about.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. A lot of the initial money went in for the upgrading of equipment in order to reinitiate some of the technical and career programming. And that equipment could have been purchased at either the colleges, or some of it might have actually occurred at the participating school districts. I will get you the budget from the program.
This is ongoing. Okay, the Range Higher Education Needs Study.
In 2007, we received an appropriation for a higher education needs assessment that was to be led by the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools and conducted in collaboration with the University of Minnesota Duluth. A consultant was hired by those the three organizations. The study was completed in January of 2008. The study included surveys of high school, college students, local residents aged 25 to 50, interviews with employers, higher ed officials. Other data was reviewed. The report demonstrated an interest of local residents and employers in expanded higher ed opportunities, but did not quantify the likely demand or enrollments in some programs of interest. The report is in its final stages of review and will be forwarded to policymakers when that's completed. Again.
I thought we got it.
Hmm. It's done.
I just thought I saw it.
No, I think it's done.
I haven't read it, but I thought I saw it. Okay. Well, we'll if we don't already have it, we probably it's in the mail.
Yeah. Oh, man, it's in the mail.
Senator Thomason.
I think it's done, but I think we're following up on it and trying to. I believe that what we just talked about
it's
in the range of vocational education is a result of that study, because the study I think indicated that that there was a need to get the local economy going in toward educating kids that would want to stay in the area, in the area of the construction trades and in area of the specialties in the mines as well as engineering, and so I think this study did demonstrate that there was a need for some of this stuff, and that's one of the reasons for the range of vocational education thing where we're going with the trying to get the high schools and the colleges together to cooperate.
Senator Thomason, are you going to have any legislation on this area?
Want me to?
Well, I was just thinking if you did, we could hear the report on the higher education needs study at that point, since we've just got kind of a little tidbit here.
Well, we could probably have somebody come in and talk about it without legislation.
Okay.
If you want to.
All right. Textbook pricing.
Madam Chair, responding to the legislation passed in 2007 that directed Minsky to initiate pilot programs to address the high cost of textbooks. Allocated $500,000 to implement the pilots. Minnesota State Colleges and Universities formed a textbook task force. Say that three times quickly. That included representatives of the Minnesota State University Student Association and the Minnesota State College Student Association, as well as faculty and administrators.
Yeah, right.
The task force constructed a request for proposals that was advertised to solicit pilot proposals. The consideration in reviewing these proposals was that the projects must aim to reduce the cost associated with textbooks for students, that they must be sustainable after the initial grant period, and that the student associations must be involved in the development and implementation of the projects. Addressing the costs of textbooks is a joint effort between administrators, faculty, and students, and given the pilots and the lessons learned, we feel that we are in a much stronger position to continue pursuing ways to lower these costs. A joint report with the Minsky system and student organizations has been recently finished and will be sent to you. I understand that's about a week, in about a week's time. There were six projects selected at different institutions for different amounts and different pilot approaches. Anoka Technical College, Minnesota State University Mankato, Minnesota West Community Technical College, South Central College, Vermilion Community College, and Hibbing Community College all had pilot projects. And the details and the information on those pilots will be in the report that was constructed.
Do you have any advanced knowledge that textbook prices actually were reduced for students?
The first cut was basically a study. I think they're looking at the different projects and a set of recommendations is coming out of it. In talking to the person that coordinated the task force, I don't think we have enough time to have seen direct impacts, but there are some steps that can be taken that will reduce the cost of textbook, may reduce the cost of textbooks to students.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Thomasoni.
Chair, you know, I would think that when textbooks are printed, they're printed from a computer. And so that they're already loaded on a computer, and you would think that just making them available online would be a logical way to go. But I was told that it's actually more expensive. I don't know if that's possible or not. No, to just have them online. I mean, almost all our kids got computers, and I would think all of them have computers. And so being able to access a textbook online, you would think would be, or on the computer, would be cheaper. But I don't know if that's true or not. Apparently there's all kinds of bureaucracies in the middle of going from the computer to the textbook and back to the computer. But I don't know. It seems to me that if they have to put it on a computer to print the textbook, that then it's already available to stay on a computer without printing the textbook. And I'm just wondering if you know anything about that. I don't know. Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
Mr. Fuller says there might be some copyright issues.
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator Lopez. Tomasoni, I was going to argue that it wasn't so much bureaucracies as legalities.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of copyright issues that are apparently are been used as the rationale for it. There are examples of, for instance, the money that was used at South Central. One of the approaches they've used is the used textbook approach. But I understand what you're saying in terms of online availability. But again, I think there are some legal questions that have to be addressed with the publishing industry.
And I would assume that there would be something in that report about sensitivity of faculty members to know what the prices are and to think about how much they need to use that book to maybe decide to just use a chapter if you can get permission to just use a couple chapters from a book instead of a whole book. Usually that costs something too. But there are other options. I know I, as a faculty member, have looked at that seriously. Do I really need this book for my students? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm most interested in kind of what the results are of this. And it was noted that, you know, there may be some things that may prove to be cost-saving to students. So I'm unclear. Does that mean that maybe the institutions maybe be looking at those things, or do you need assistance, or what's the next step? Because there was a lot of energy around this discussion.
Right. Mr. Lopez.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, my understanding, and I haven't seen the report, is that there are some significant recommendations in it that will require some effort. I think the student associations representatives can probably more clearly indicate what some of those things might be. But I think there are some significant, I was told there were some significant recommendations that are coming out of the task force report that, again, is due shortly. There were six very different pilots, and there are different approaches to this. And I can't speak as to the whole set of recommendations, but I understand some of them are quite significant and would require some changes in policy and procedure and possibly even some legal issues.
Okay, let's just hear about board policies and degree requirements, and then I'll apologize for everybody else who came. It ended up being the Vice Chancellor Lopez show today, but we definitely, you know what we're interested in, and we're going to schedule you to come back.
Me too.
Well, was this the last thing that you're covering,
Vice President? Yeah, but I have a couple of answers to provide you, yes.
Okay. Yeah, you do. You have to come back.
The board policy on degree requirements. As current statute requires us to place caps on our programs, baccalaureate and associate degree programs, and to have a policy in place by January of 2009. The board did passed the policy in January, and they've met that stipulation of the legislation. The procedure was approved by Chancellor McCormick a week later, and that's actually taking the policy and implementing it and putting it into practice over time. The forms, the instructions, the timelines have been developed, and they're posted to a website that faculty and students have access to. And then the second set of questions was how many programs have requested and received a waiver. The policy's new. It's actually just needed. The policy was just passed in January. There have been no formal waiver applications, although we have received one notice of intent. What we're trying to do is manage the process because one of the concerns that was raised legislatively, I know on the House side, I assume also on the Senate side, was the consistency or lack of consistency in the length of programs of similar name. So one of the things we've tried to put in place is a process where we can address that systematically. So the first step in our process was to ask the institutions to give us a notice of intent by June 30th of this year. And this is actually my staff, so I'm fully aware of this piece. We will put together that list and look, if we've got there are six programs of a certain type and none are going to seek a waiver, obviously there's not much of a problem there. We've got six programs of a certain type, and all are going to seek a waiver. We'll work with the six to figure out what the basis for that might be and engage in conversations with them. What I'm more concerned about is the programs, 10, 15, 20 of them across the state, where some think they can meet the requirement and some feel they need a waiver. We then would call groups together and start discussing that. One of the concessions was that curricular processes are generally faculty-generated, and we wanted to let the faculties on the at the institutional level make a decision whether they thought that particular program that they were involved with needed to seek a waiver or not. Once those initial decisions are made, the Office of the Chancellor will get involved in calling groups of faculty together. We have some informal groups I've already met with and will meet with in the next, actually some tomorrow and then in the next couple of weeks, to start talking about similarities and dissimilarities of programs. So that process is in place. So we are in the process of discussions with faculty groups. In particular, I can give you some examples. There are a large number, but automotive mechanic, automotive technicians, we're meeting next week, a week after next. All the programs in the state are going to get together at St. Cloud Tech, and I'm going to meet with them. We're going to talk about the issues that they may have and how some approaches to resolving the differences, if there are differences, amongst the programs. The medical lab technicians are meeting tomorrow in a WebEx type of meeting for the perhaps the third time we've met with them to work out some issues that are of consistency and difference. So we're engaged in the process, and we have had several associate degree programs that have reduced down to 60 credits. We do not as yet, we have not as yet granted a waiver because the process is too new, and we do want, before we grant the waiver, we do want to have an opportunity for the faculty to decide individually whether they need it, and then the ability to call like programs together to find out what the similarities and differences might be. Just because they have a similar name or similar classification on the national classification system doesn't necessarily mean they are the same. So we want to be able to explore that with them.
Okay, I think members do have an interest in this area, so there'll be more discussion. In interest of time, I'll save my lecture on the topic. And ask members if they to please put your handouts that you got from staff in your folders. Then you'll have them when we return to this, the rest of the questions at a later date. And thank you all very much for attending, and thanks to everyone in the audience. And it was a very interesting.